Okay, I guess we're going to go ahead and get started. Good morning. I'm Frank Verastro. I'm director of the energy program here at CSIS. And for those of you that have joined us before, because this is the fifth or sixth installment of the series, it keeps growing. We're doing this jointly with the National Renewable Energy Lab in Golden, Colorado, and Dr. Doug Arendt of NREL is here with us today, and with the Global Strategy Institute. And we have Eric Peterson, our senior VP at CSIS and director of the Global Strategy Institute. Eric's going to serve as the moderator for this morning's sessions. Doug will do comments at the end. As with all previous sessions, this is totally on the record. The presentations will be posted. If you'll save your questions towards the end, that'll be really helpful so we can get through this. We've got a great panel discussion today. This installment is carbon to liquids. And just for calendar purposes, we're looking to probably a late February date that we'll notify you of to do automotive technologies as the continuing part of this series. And I'm thinking February 24th, if I haven't misstated that. That's what we're going to go ahead and do. Just two quick points for those of you, since our speakers have come from a fairly long way. And out of courtesy to them and the people around you, if you'll turn off your cell phones at this point, that would be extremely helpful. And I think we're going to try to post the materials on the website, if not this afternoon, by first thing tomorrow. Okay? And with that, I will turn the program over to Eric, and we can just go ahead and get started. But thank you all for coming.
Frank, thank you very much. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm delighted to have the opportunity to moderate today's proceedings. Just by way of introductory background on today's structure, we'll have four sequential presentations, after which we will pool questions. So please, we hope to move quickly. Please write down your questions, and we look forward to getting a number of perspectives on various questions or comments after the presentations. Now, you all should have received biographies of each of the speakers. If you haven't, please see Jennifer outside. But because of that, I hope they'll forgive me. I'll abbreviate my introduction so that we can get right into the substance that, after all, has brought us here this morning. We will go in the batting order that is in the agenda in front of you. So I'll be introducing each of our speakers in turn as he approaches the podium. So we'll begin then with Carl Bauer. Carl Bauer is director of the National Energy Transportation Technology Laboratory, a national laboratory owned and operated by the U.S. Department of Energy. In this position, he oversees the implementation of major science and technology development programs to resolve the environmental supply and reliability constraints of producing and using fossil resources. This includes technologies for advanced coal-fueled power generation and hydrogen production, carbon sequestration, environmental control for the existing fleet of coal-fired power plants, and improving the efficiency and environmental quality of domestic oil and natural gas exploration, production, and processing. We're absolutely delighted to have him here today. Carl, thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning. I'd like to thank both the CSIS and NREL for the hosting of this. I look forward to having a good exchange. I'd like to make a few things to set the stage while they death by laser pointer. But sorry, that it has to be dealt with. So we are assuming that approaching these technologies, we will be dealing with greenhouse gas as appropriate. And these are the studies are not about the economics, but about the possibilities. What you see on here, that pretty picture there, is actually out at 2030. The 2030, that is actually the level predicted by EIA for the AEO6 requirements of liquid fuels or oil equivalent energy. And what we've done is, you'll see through the chart, is to talk about what are the possibilities of addressing that demand. We assumed, as I said, that the environmental requirements, including greenhouse gas, will have to be met. But we've taken a little different approach in addressing it, and that's why the import looks substantially less than the AE6 would present. What we've done is suggest that based on our studies and based on analysis of many reports from both industry and other associations and laboratories, there are possibilities that should be considered so you would have a more diverse energy portfolio with the possibility of making a contribution to addressing the energy requirements of the nation, and especially the liquid fuel requirements, which are probably the most significant challenge this nation faces. So with that, I'll move forward. Starting out with this chart that was presented by Dave Garman when he was here about 6 months ago, I think it was June, and you notice that what this chart basically says is this is only coal resources, oil, shale resources, petroleum already consumed, our existing reserves, this thin red line here, remaining original oil in place, that percent that's recoverable uncertain. In other words, it's there, and as you probably realize, when you pursue an oil reservoir, you don't get more than 40% of the oil that's estimated to be in there out based on present technologies and economics. Tar sands, heavy oil, and the coal already consumed. That's a little bit better way to read that. Well, if you took the already consumed portions out of that chart and you still looked at that chart, you would see that that chart is worth about seven times the world's total proven oil reserves, including the U.S. is proportion of that, which is about 2%. So we have domestic resources that I guess you would say are semi-traditional in the sense that they're the what's often thought about as fossil fuel resources. That is seven times the world's proven, if we could find the way to access them. However, this is another way to look at it. This dark blue wedge here represents 687 billion barrels of oil equivalent, and it's based on coal, petroleum, and natural gas from known or proven reserves, and it is a very small portion. I'm going to do a little, try to appreciate what we really have, and this is not, by the way, as you may think from this presentation, a pushing of fossil fuels. It's more setting the stage of the realities that exist. Because I will say right now, fossil fuels are not the only answer, nor are they the adequate answer, but they are part of the answer. And so we need to know what that means. So that, look at that blue wedge there, dark blue wedge. That's all the things that are economically viable and are being approached to be produced today. Then we have several other pieces to add to it. We have the oil shale, which has gotten a lot of play. And I've lost it. There we go. We have heavy oil sands. We have the remaining oil for EOR that has some need for increased EOR capabilities to be produced. And then we have various aspects of coal, some of which is undiscovered, some of which is inferred. And this Alaskan hypothetical is based on the state of Alaska's evaluation of what coal is really up there. You see it's quite sizable. And then that white, you might be wondering, what is that white, about 65-70% of the pie? That's methane hydrates. That's being pursued from a federal standpoint. We have a very minimal investment there. Other countries have substantially more. Industry, in fact, Chevron is pursuing hydrates as well as other major oil companies. And it is a huge potential resource. But what that really says is this. What we're pursuing, this wedge here, what we know how to produce from, what we have an assurance of results from, is 1.4% of the domestic possible resources. 1.4% that is technologically and economically viable to reach, produce, and make available for the use of the country. The other 98.6% does not have the technology, or you could say the price in the market, depending on how you want to look at it, to really be realized. Now, in the methane hydrates, it's definitely a technology issue, because even if we quadrupled the price of gas right now, heaven forbid, we wouldn't be able to put methane hydrates into the pipeline next year. But it is out there. Well, I'm not foolish enough to suggest that we're going to get all that 98.6% out into the market or achieve that in the next 2 decades. That's not what I'm suggesting. What I am suggesting is, think about this. If we could take that other 98.6% and produce additional 2%, or even just double our present ability to produce, That would be a substantial benefit to this country. It would address many issues about both the energy dependence and independence, and that's not the whole story. If we could produce it from all of that, we would have 42 times the proven world oil reserves. So just think, if we just doubled the 1.4% producing to 3% of our total possibility, what that would mean. And it requires technology, and it requires economics. If you have the higher prices, you have more investment. We see oil fields coming back online that weren't economical a decade ago. With the price of oil now, they are producing. So those things happen. But if you want it in a timely manner, it requires the investment. So I'm from a national lab, so you assume I'm pushing it for R&D. I'm not pushing it for R&D. I'm just suggesting the possibilities. And it's really a policy decision on how it gets invested to bring things forward. So that's just basically what one would consider, I'll say, traditionally fossil fuel potential resources. Now, going to the chart that I had on the front page, but showing it as the AEO 6 presentation does, we see that this chart shows that 53% of the 2030 liquids will come from imports, 53%. You can see this smaller wedge in the middle is the imports, where we actually don't even have the refinery capable to produce oil that we need as far as refined product. So we actually get refined product on top of the imported crudes that we have to get. Now, inherent in that report was not shown in that previous slide is this smaller portion here that is ethanol, coal to liquids, and oil shale production. Ethanol from the AEO6 report is this very small blue line across the top. A magenta or purple is coal to liquids, and then oil shale is a small wedge over here. And they all run back, all the way back to thinking things may come online as early as 2012, if you look at the report. What we've done in our study is look at many things. This study will be out on our website in about 8 weeks. It's in the final draft form. We're doing a peer review of it. We want to make sure that what we put out there is well-referenced and reasonable. We are not taking the approach which EIA is somewhat forced to take, which is using what they would consider reasonably produced technologies. Their reports have to base themselves on things that are technologically proven to the point of almost commercial or, in fact, commercial. So that hampers them from looking at all the possibilities. We've taken the approach of saying, what are the possibilities? What could be done, what is being worked at to various degrees in industry and in academia and nation, and if we looked at that portfolio of possible sources, what do we think is realistically with the price of oil presently and what we would suggest is the future price based on both AEO6's high oil price, what would come out. So you'll see that. And that's what that looks like. Now, if you remember that flag on the front page, you might notice this looks similar to that. The stripes are this part of various different technologies, biodiesel, ethanol, cellulosic ethanol, electric drive of vehicles to reduce consumption, increased efficiencies, and I'll talk a little bit about that. But what that does is get this to 15%, and this is, I still left this part in here, which is the coal liquids that we saw before and the traditional ethanol from corn production, as well as the lower part there. So let's go forward and talk a little more about that. There are the items. I'm not going to go, I don't have time in 20 minutes to develop each one of those technical areas, but I think if you look at them, if you look at various reports from industry, NREL's studies, RAND studies, SSEB studies, you'll find many of these different technologies have been considered and what is possible from them has been predicted. We've looked at those. We've tried to rationalize the assumptions in the studies with other factors and come up with what we think is a fairly aggressive but realistic possibility. I emphasize possibility. But you see here hydrogen fuel vehicles from coal, from wind, from nuclear, coal plug-ins, electric vehicles in there, oil sands, biomass for gasification, cellulosic ethanol, EOR, CTO, additional CTL, oil shale in a more aggressive manner than is added up here. That's oil shale there. This is more of it. And even fuel efficiency, this larger wedge down the bottom here of vehicles. Just to refer you back to the cover slide, that's how it looks. So now you know what the stripes were based on. Wait a flag. Okay. With the possibility of that, I'd like to inject another idea. This is not what you would call a technical idea. But we often talk about interdependence or independence. But when we think of interdependence, we almost think of where we are, where someone's got the supply and we have to take what they offer and we're dependent on them. They're dependent because if we don't buy their product, they may not have the money. But if you look what's been happening in the world, that isn't always the way it works anymore. What we're suggesting, if you have an advantageous interdependence, you're in a position where the country is no longer a price taker, yet it may not also be a price setter, but it would be in a position that it could negotiate and discuss things in a way that would allow a little more level playing field between a nation that is no longer a fully consuming nation, but a nation that has resources that has found a way to utilize both economically and with all the issues around environmental and greenhouse gas considered, still economically, in the world marketplace of demand. And so the nations that have been traditional suppliers find themselves in a situation that it's to their advantage to talk with us and it's in our advantage to talk with them. It also allows a more balanced look at bringing forth the various technologies, if that is the goal. It's not, I've got to get there with everything. I need a silver bullet to solve the problem so I'm independent. It also doesn't put us in a situation. Think about this. If you were a supplier and I was going to basically take off your source of income, would you think that was threatening? You have a nation that depends on the income you generate from energy, and all of a sudden I'm threatening to cut that in half, and you know that some of the people in the country that have been living off the benefits of energy are not going to get paid or not going to have finances or you're not going to have the things to keep the infrastructures running. Would you feel threatened? Is that the opposite of holding the price gun to our head but still with the same bottom line reality? I believe it is. Now, I'm wading in areas that as a researcher is beyond my realm of possibilities, but I do think it is a good policy argument to be discussed if, from a technological standpoint and a commitment standpoint, we were willing to go forward and find those resources to make the technologies available to deal with the various issues so we'd have a more balanced portfolio of possibilities and not predetermine which technologies will succeed, but let the course be set by investing to get them there with a goal. Some of them won't make it. We know that. So that's just a thought. Now, if you took those stripes on the chart, this is what they look like represented in a bar. And over here are some of the reports. That's AL, not aluminum, by the way, for you chemists out there. That's the NETL paper that will be out soon, which I produce here. The blue bars are from that report. The yellow bars are from a recent report by the Southern States Energy Board. Many of you may be aware of that if you've been interested in energy. And the EIA paper, need energy for this laser here, EIA 806 replaced, and then DOE's goal only shown in one area. And what you see is this blue from our study is not as high in every case as other studies have suggested, but exists in other cases that isn't suggested in any of the reports. We have wind plug-ins and hybrids in there. We have coal plug-ins and hybrids, nuclear plug-ins and hybrids. What we're saying, the issue about fuel also considers alternative ways of powering vehicles. If I can run vehicles on electricity, and we already know we can, right? We see it done, whether it's purely electricity or whether it's a Prius or a Ford or whatever has a hybrid. And we all know there's already talk now that some of them are going to have a plug-in vehicle so that if you're in the urban area, you have a possibility of just using electricity routinely, not even shifting over to your gasoline or diesel engine. Biomass, this is thermal conversion versus chemical conversion. Looking at biomass from both sources, looking at coal to liquids, looking at enhanced oil recovery, and what is the possibilities there. This NCC is National Coal Council, by the way. SSEB is Southern States Energy Board. And like I said, that's not aluminum. That's an advantageous interdependence report that we're going to put out. Fuel efficiency, we were a little less bullish on the possibilities, but we still thought it's important to be looking to get fuel efficiency. And like I said, we looked at and we tried to say from a kind of a optimistic conservative perspective of what possibly could be done if we went across a portfolio like this. I think it's important, this discussion of liquid fuels, because if we only go coal to liquids, or we only go biodiesel, or we only go ethanol, none of those is the answer in and of itself. All those have various environmental issues to be dealt with. The amount, for example, if you cook the soybean crop in the United States today and convert it all to biodiesel, that's 300,000 barrels a day of biodiesel. Well, we use 20-plus billion barrels a day. So we know that's an answer, but it's not the answer. It's part of the answer. On the other hand, if you talk coal to liquids, we have to deal with the greenhouse gas issue and other things. How is that dealt with? So this is only to foster and stimulate some issues about how do we solve a serious problem. And there are no simple answers, but there are multitudinous contributions to the answers, and we'd like to suggest that those need to be dealt with. Now, I want to show you one little thing here. Whoop, sorry about that. I got to go back. There you go. All right. If you look at two things here, try this other laser pointer. I'm not doing good with any of them. Yeah. All right. We'll go back to, as they told me, the appropriate. The appropriate pointer in a not-for-profit organization.
Thank you.
So I'll walk over here. If you look at the biomass Fischer-Tropsch chemical conversion,
thanks.
If you look at this and you look at the biomass there and the C2L there, okay, I want to suggest something. I'm looking forward for Professor Williams' presentation because he's going to talk more about this. And, in fact, some of his papers were some of the things we looked on to draw some opportunities from. So I'm really looking forward to have you what you used to say. If you look at the thermal conversion, that's gasification of biomass, and you look at coal to liquids, if you took the blue bar here and the blue bar here and you added them together, you might find them come very close to the DOE goal for liquids from biomass in general. To try to get there from the standpoint of biochemical conversion and biomass, I think it's going to find a much difficult stretch. Bob's got some very interesting things to say, so I'm not going to steal your thunder, but I think we need to listen to that and look at that. And what I've just realized is somehow I've got the wrong presentation here. It's not the complete, but I want to go to the summary because I think my 20 minutes are up. The point is this. The extent of our energy resources are much greater than we talk about. And if we could just double our use of them, which would mean 3% of our total domestic resources, it would put us in a substantially more advantageous position to handle many of the challenges on the international marketplace. However, doing that requires technology, requires continued increased dealing with the various issues of both greenhouse gas and other environmental, whether it's air pollution, whether it's the environmental extraction of resources from our domestic wildlife and lands. There are technological hurdles. I believe they're certainly achievable. We've been a nation. One of our greatest successes and why in a world that doesn't always honor copyrights and patents, we still succeed is we have been able to outdevelop the plagiarizers. Think about that. We have been able to outdevelop the plagiarizers. We've been able to come up with technologies that are always ahead, even though someone has reverse engineered or flat out stolen a patent or a copyright or whatever. We need to continue to invest in doing that. I'm going to go off on a sidebar for a second. That requires well-trained minds. It's one of our other big challenges is having the resources of educated, talented scientists and engineers to help contribute to the solutions we need. And as you all probably know, our universities are not graduating an adequate number of people, which means the pipeline at the other end is not getting enough people interested in science and engineering and math into the universities, which really tells us we need to start in the grammar school telling people why it's interesting to be in those fields and encouraging to go forward. Back to the paper. Diversity of alternatives allows for a conservative individual goal in each area. I don't have to have cellulosic ethanol think they have to carry the day. I have to have them believe they've got to find a way to make it economically viable. But the whole solution is not on their back, which they really can't get to. And they know that because when you do the numbers, it's like, I mean, think about it. How would you like to go to bed every saying, I've got an impossible mission. I have no idea how to get there. I just hope I can get there. I'm going to run harder. I need more money. but you reach a point where no matter how much money you throw at a problem, it can't get there faster. It allows for a balance. I think it also allows for this advantageous interdependence to become a philosophy approach. So with that, I'll end, and I'll be involved with the panel later. Thank you for your attention.
Carl, thank you very much. Thank you very much. We'll now shift gears. Don Paul, the Vice President and Chief Technology Officer of Chevron Corporation, will be speaking. He is the corporate officer at Chevron responsible for its three technology companies, namely Energy Technology, Information Technology, and Technology Ventures. In this role, Don manages the research, development, and integrated application of technology throughout the company's worldwide business activities. Don is a member of Chevron's Strategy and Planning Committee. He will be addressing himself this morning to alternative fuels, carbons to liquids, and we're very grateful to him for joining us this morning. Don, over to you.
Well, thank you and good morning. It's a pleasure to be here. I want to thank NREL and CSIS for putting together this panel, and a very distinguished one it is. And I want to thank Carl for his first talk, because I think he really addressed one of the key aspects of energy that maybe isn't recognized, and that is that we're not running out of molecules. There's lots and lots of molecules. Now, the twist I'm going to take on it as a fuel producer at scale is understanding the other parts of the system that actually directly impact your ability to have fuel. I'm going to focus on fuel, although power obviously is an important aspect, but I would agree with Carl that the challenge is fuel, and the reason the challenge is fuel is because almost all of it comes from one supply chain. So the subjects I'd like to talk about and leave you with some thoughts. Talk about the fuel supply system, particularly issues around scale, time, and capital. A lot of people think, well, if you just have a new source, you'll have new fuel. Yeah, maybe, but there's a lot of other things in between. I do want to talk about carbon to liquids, and in this case, really, it means everything. Carbon is, in a sense, unless you get all the way to hydrogen, is the carrier of energy for fuel. And this includes everything. I'll talk a little bit about that. But the key message here is we're moving to an era of synthetic fuels. And the whole history of fuel making is basically distilling fuels, taking crude oil, boiling it. In fact, that's what refiners call it, boiling oil, picking off the fractions that you want for given uses. That's quite different than breaking things down and making the molecules you want. So synthetic fuels open lots of opportunities in this area. The underlying technology is your ability to do things at the molecular scale, transform molecules. I'll talk about that in some summary thoughts. If you look at the fuel supply system, this is a little pictorial of this supply chain. A couple things I'd like you to come away with. One, it is a supply chain. So boosting one element of it, do we figure out which one works?
I think that one does.
Yeah, okay. Whether it's adding feedstock here, manufacturing the fuel, distributing it, eventually getting it to where it's used, it is a supply chain. So enhancing one piece is probably useful, but it may or may not be decisive. And that's something that a lot of people forget. And when you think about adding new feedstocks, and that's primarily what we're going to talk about here, and perhaps new processes, one of the questions is, does it plug in here somewhere? If you have synthetic crude from Alberta, yes, it just kind of plugs into the system and it looks like crude and it gets processed through the system. Or if you're thinking about biofuels, now you need a whole infrastructure in parallel. These things have different implications. But some of the things here is that I'm talking about is the scale. And I want to cover that a little bit more in this next slide. It's the world's largest supply chain. It's very tightly integrated. It took basically a century to build. Now it's been arguably altered materially since World War II. And with long-haul tankers, it got changed again, the globalized crude system. But it's very large. We use 40,000 gallons a second on this planet. That's basically half a gallon for every human every single day. So the scale problem is not insignificant. In fact, it's enormous. And when you think that it's not just that you produce it somewhere, but it's got to get into the system. Even in the U.S., there's 250 billion gallons just moving around being redistributed in the system today. 250 billion gallons. People are talking about getting excited at producing 15, that would be the next benchmark, 15 billion gallons of ethanol. It's still a small fraction of the total fuel system. So that's a key part of it. Time. It takes decades. That's one aspect. But the other aspect a lot of people forget is that you live with it for practically forever. When you install one of these facilities, you have it for a long time. That materially affects the kind of business models that you can have in this business. Our Richmond refinery celebrated its 100th year several years ago. Now, it's obviously been turned over with engineering, but if you go out and build a large set of infrastructure built on a technology that perhaps is ready technically but maybe not ready commercially, then you have it. And then you have it for a very long time. Perhaps you wish you didn't if you owned it. Those are one of the things. And even giant oil fields take 20 years from discovery to production. So the system takes time and scale. And then capital, these are round numbers today. Some people argue that's too low. It's $10 a barrel to add reserves on average. Some places lower, some places higher. It takes about $20,000 of capital per daily barrel of manufacturing. This is conventional refining. When we get into some of the more exotic conversion, that number is much higher. That's a key question. That's a key aspect of unconventional fuels. Coal to liquids, shale oil. What you're trading is capital for low-cost feedstock. That has a very different economic model than one in which you drill, discover a big field like we did in the Gulf of Mexico, and produce something where you get all your money back in 5 years once you start producing. That's important because that affects the financing structure, and the financing structure is trillions. You could argue about what this number is. Some people have even tossed out numbers. We haven't, but people have tossed out numbers that are tens of trillions over the next 30 years to build out this. One of the reasons why this is expected is because we saw in Carl's talk, talked a lot about U.S., but the big growth in world fuel demand is not in the United States, it's not in Europe, not in Japan, it's China, it's India, Southeast Asia. And these numbers are daunting. Today, we use 1,000 barrels a second, 85 million barrels a day. What is the world going to do for supply if it's 120? And one of the questions, is there a lot of active studies, one that Frank and I are involved in, is already saying, well, can the system support numbers that look like that? Can you support 120 million? I would argue that the big opportunity for unconventionals is to wedge their way into that growth segment, not just in the United States, but on a worldwide basis. So let's talk about unconventional resources. And what I'm – and everybody's got a little bit different classification, but the one that we're thinking about are extra heavy oils, bitumen, like the Athabasca tar sands, coal, of course, which you heard a lot about, oil shale, and then a couple of others, non-traditional gas. What I mean by this is using gas as a feedstock as opposed to a fuel directly. It could also mean there are non-traditional sources of gas. Actually, U.S. has quite a bit of it. If you think about gas shales and other kinds of basin-centered gas, non-traditional reservoirs, and then hydrates. You mentioned hydrates. I guess my only comment on hydrates are there's lots of it. In fact, one could argue that majority of all the natural gas is actually held in hydrates. The questions are, can you produce it? Is it concentrated enough? One of the things that we have with these resources, and I'll come to biomass, which is a special case, is that over geologic time, these were biomass, of course. So let's get that fact out. All of this was biomass at one time. It's just the geology converted it over time to these other forms. And I had a long time to do it, and we're now using it in a much shorter period of time. But these are all basically originally started with biomass. And then biomass has some particular characteristics, and I'll talk about them later, which make them a challenge. They're certainly an opportunity. But these are all enormous resource bases. Let me give you an example. Here's some data EIA and IEA data, and we can argue about the specific numbers. I don't think that's important, but it's the scale. What we're showing here is two things, so don't get them confused. One is reserves. These are producible today with current economics and current technology, and resources, which are different. Okay. But I think that one of the issues that are clear is if you look at oil and gas, the distribution of oil and gas is obviously, as was pointed out, is a challenge for North America. I mean, we have some, but it's pretty small. On the other hand, as you get over to these shale oil, coal, and heavy, extra heavy, this would probably be extra heavy, all of a sudden you see that North America is actually in a prime position. So it's not like the hydrocarbons are kind of uniformly distributed. It's just that where you got them out of the geological system is quite a bit different. But it's clear to us that if you look at something like coal in particular, the two big concentrations of coal in the world happen to be in the two biggest consumers, the U.S. and China. So it's pretty logical to think that if you can solve with science the technical, capital, and environmental problems, this has got to be a player in the game, as with shale oil as well. Those are not simple, but the key point is enormous numbers. Just a comment about oil. People talk about a trillion. That's a trillion barrels. We've used a trillion. We used a trillion in the first 120 years or so of using oil. We'll use the trillion that's on the books in probably another 30. And depending on who you look, the USGS, for example, would say that there's another trillion left. So out of the original light oil, and this isn't the heavy oil, extra heavy oil, or any of these, traditional light oil, which, by the way, is what people have lived off of because of its ability to basically distill and make the products you want. Each of these have much more complexity to them to turn them into a fuel you want. And that's really where I'm going to go with the rest of the talk. So let's talk about a couple of these. And Chevron, by the way, is really involved in looking at all of these. Our general view on this is you're going to need every molecule you can get your hands on from all the sources on a global scale as over the next 25 or 30 years, and therefore time to get on with these other feedstocks and time to get on with building a synthetic fuel business to go along with the traditional oil business. If you think about natural gas, which, of course, one of the interesting characteristics about natural gas is that it actually is much earlier on its development cycle than oil on a global scale, much earlier. Oil, some people would argue, some people have argued, that you've maxed out already. You've seen that in the press and by various advocates. But gas is much earlier. So can you use gas as a feedstock to make fuel? And the answer is you can. The first fuels are entering the premium markets today. Commercial plants at scale are under construction around the world. Still a small fraction of the total world's fuel supply. There's a lot of R&D effort, and I'm sure we'll hear some from Ken about Centrolium's efforts. There's a lot of R&D effort to try to reduce the cost of capital in these plants. Now, one of the aspects of gas today is it really works when you're connected to really big and really inexpensive gas resources at scale. That's why there are major developments in Qatar, some in West Africa. You may see some later at other times in places like Australia, other places that have major gas. But one of the key points is that from a diversification point of view for the U.S. supply, gas is distributed potentially somewhat differently than oil. And it's earlier in the development cycle. Key aspect, and this will come up again, this is a key element of synthetic fuel business that is distinct from the current refining business. You're going to create a new manufacturing base, and it's going to be distributed at the resource. Today, the supply chain that we have with oil has, well, that's actually back to the future. That's the way oil used to be. You discovered a big oil field, you built a refinery. As the supply chain became more sophisticated for oil, it became more efficient on a cost basis, and on a distribution infrastructure basis to build big central refineries, particularly along the coasts, as supertankers came in, and then just move crude around. We're back to the future with unconventional resources. You basically build the manufacturing at the resource base. Why? Well, we'll come to that in a minute. But here's one example with gas. You can have a huge gas accumulation, like the Northwest Shelf of Australia development we're involved in. You're a long ways from where that fuel is going to be used. You can't ship the gas. Now, you do ship LNG in the use of gas as gas. But if you're talking about making a fuel, you got to make it where you have it. And that's going to be characteristic of the others as well. And sitting underneath this, and the opportunity, is the advancement of science around changing molecules, because all of these require you to do something significant with the molecules besides heat them up and sort them on the basis of their thermal characteristics. Let me talk about synthetic oil from extra-heavy bitumen. We are, this is a typical activity today in Alberta. Dig it up. It's a mining operation. Looks a lot like surface mining of coal. Separate it from the sand, process it. A lot of people are starting to think about in situ, which is more of a where you don't mine the surface, also the deposits are deeper. Get down underneath, actually do things in the reservoir, produce the bitumen. Ultimately, though, bitumen has to be upgraded. One of the things that a lot, and biofuels being the exception, and gas, the liquids being the exception, but if you think of bitumen, shale, to some extent, but certainly coal, they're all deficient in hydrogen. Hydrogen is what turns them into a fuel. So making hydrogen, a lot of people don't talk about it, but if you get a significant synthetic fuel business from coal and Athabasca, tar sands, and oil shales, you're going to make massive amounts of hydrogen. And actually, making hydrogen is the primary source, unless you use nuclear, it's the primary source of making CO2 as well. So making hydrogen is at scale is a key issue. We do make it now in our refineries, but you're talking about something vastly bigger. So how do you make hydrogen efficiently at scale? Today we make it from natural gas. I think this is one of the key challenges as not solving as a technical problem, but how do you make it big enough to matter? Obviously, energy and carbon management. Shale oil leases, there's some RD&D leases underway. We're involved. Shell is involved. I think this is a long-term play. It's a research play. It's interesting that Dave O'Reilly, Chevron's chairman, his first field assignment was actually building a shale plant in the last boom. So it took a little bit of work moving shale along, but in all seriousness, it clearly is a huge resource, tremendous hydrocarbon densities in shales. You're talking about a million barrels per acre, potentially. So very interesting, long way to go on the time. Let me talk about shift now to biofuels. A lot going on. Today, primary production, of course, in the U.S. from corn, from sugarcane in Brazil. One of the characteristics about biofuels is the whole issue of surplus biomass, not just food, but all the other, the big parts of the system, which involve timber, waste, potentially the idea of genetically engineered special purpose energy crops, all of these things. As you look around the world, you might ask yourself, where is the biomass surplus? That is, the surplus over what society needs for other uses, sufficiently large to make a difference. And certainly, two areas stand out, and it's not a surprise that they're early on the curve. One is U.S.-Canada, which I view really as an integrated energy system. I think that U.S. and Canada have to be treated that way. And Brazil. And there may be some others, but what you need to make biomass business is land and enormous quantities of it. So one of the key challenges today you're approaching 500,000 barrels a day, approaching. There are a lot of plants under construction in the U.S. One of the challenges about biomass is the feedstock is distributed, just like it was before it became oil over geologic time. It's spread out. To give you some numbers, just a couple numbers are useful in the bio discussion. People in bio fuels talk about gallons per year. That's the unit of production. which is interesting because in the fuel business we talk about barrels per day. But a handy conversion, if you don't want to whip up your calculator, is 1,000 barrels a day is 15 million gallons a year. So when somebody says, I got a big honking ethanol plant, 150 million gallons, which is a big ethanol plant, that's 10,000 barrels a day, approximately 5% the size of a major refinery. So what is it about biofuels that's special? Remember, we talked about infrastructure? What's special is it's highly distributed manufacturing system. The largest plant under construction in the United States today, Archer Daniel Midlands, is talking about something that is 20,000 barrels a day or so, much smaller than a small refinery. So the nature of biofuels is the source is distributed. That is the feedstock. It's got to be gathered, brought together, processed. But the processing units are also relatively small. And so the distribution system for bio is a new system that somehow has to be worked out. There's a lot of stuff being moved around. One of the things I didn't mention with coal, but it's important, critical path infrastructure in coal, even in coal today, is the fact that coal from the mine mouth primarily travels by rail car to its usage at utilities. That works okay for utilities, but if you were to increase the amount of coal, say double the amount of coal that you might be using, what one of the questions you'd come is, where are all the railroads? And would you start, and if you start putting plants at mine mouths, then you need pipelines. And so I think one of the key things that a lot of people don't think about here, as you create a new fuel supply system, is all the other parts. The parts that connect feedstock, the plant, the gathering station to markets. Some of it you can use, like the Canadian tar sands, when they produce a synthetic crude from bitumen, goes in through the pipelines out of Canada into the refining system, primarily in the Midwest. That works okay. But I think this is a key challenge. It is particularly a challenge. And the other aspect, which was already mentioned, is I think most people believe that the key to significant growth in biofuel production is what we are calling, what you call second generation, where you're really going directly for direct conversion of cellulose, where you have very large supplies. So where does the scale in the infrastructure and how does it get built? It will be different because the plants are much smaller in general. There are also tend to be highly concentrated in one part of the U.S. You need second generation, and then how do you concentrate feedstock? Can you concentrate it more? Is the agricultural system built to support that? I think it's a good question. I've talked about this. Let me talk about the key underlying issue. Almost all these unconventional resources require significant molecular rearrangement. You're talking about synthesizing fuels. You talk about breaking down what you have, generally, then assembling them. Or in the case of the extra heavy, like bitumen, adding hydrogen, adding it in the right places in the molecules. The good news is, about all of this, is the ability to engineer at the molecular scale, whether it's inorganic, which is what we do with catalysis, or whether it's biological, which is a lot of what's going on in the biofuels area. Same point. Your ability to engineer precisely the ability to convert, break down, and reassemble molecules from feedstock is the key technology. This, of course, has advanced enormously. Big application historically has been in things like pharmaceuticals and health in the bio end. But we can do things with catalysis today that you couldn't imagine doing 10 years ago in both the design of these reaction surfaces and the ability to make them with precision and therefore the ability to literally move hydrogen atoms on a consistent basis around molecules to get the fuel you want. And that's the opportunity set, is that you can take perhaps less expensive feedstock and make what you want. You can take advantage of new engine technologies. The ability to synthesize a fuel is now freed from what you would get by just distilling crude oil, where the engines have basically been tuned to match what you could make, with some exceptions. Now you can think about engines that actually could deliver based on what kind of molecules you'd like to have. So there's lots of opportunities in this area. One of the challenges here, just to close up in a minute, is the scale that it takes to develop fuel technology. This is an illustrative example. But if you think about going from a benchtop activity today where you've validated a new chemical reaction, new catalyst, cost a few millions, produce little pints, then you build a pilot plant in the lab. This is something that looks just like a refinery, except it's miniature. Makes about a barrel a day, cost a few tens of millions. But you can't go from this to 100,000 barrels. You can't jump by a factor of 100,000 in production scale. Well, you can, but you probably wouldn't be happy with what happened. So we typically build experimental plants, and I think you'll start to see more of these built as people develop these more sophisticated, particularly unconventional processing. But this still, you're spending hundreds of millions for what is a throwaway device, and it takes 10 years. So back to where we started. It takes a lot of money. It takes a long time. That's not a reason to be discouraged. It's just part of the way the system. So let me wrap up when we talk about unconventional fuels. One key characteristic is the resource bases are enormous. That's the really good news. There's lots of molecules. The challenge is to make a business of delivering fuel. And remember, fuel has to show up every single day. People get very unhappy if it doesn't show up every single day. And do it at scale, enormous scale. And so this requires building new businesses that kind of go from all the way from the rock or whatever this material is all the way to the pump. Creating new value chains and new business models is part of the challenge because they don't have the same economics, they don't have the same structure, and in some cases they don't have literally the same physical infrastructure. It's synthetic fuel manufacturing. That would be an important takeaway. This in and of itself is extremely important. The idea that you move from distilling to synthesis is, in my view, a fundamental break in the whole idea of how we're going to power societies. It's built around the ability to transform molecules, whether it's inorganic or biological. But that's the good news, because that's something that obviously our science and technology is getting much, much better at. So we will have more opportunities, I think, there over time. Infrastructure development is crucial. It doesn't do any good to just have another source. It has to fit into the system so that it can be processed and distributed in an economic fashion. Carbon. I'd like to make a couple of comments on this as I close. Many of these unconventional resources, well, let's start with the one that's starting today. Athabasca is underway. Enormous scale. Anybody who's ever been up there is just staggering to see the scale of this development. Given the length of time these resources last, one thing we heard from Carl's talk is these resources last centuries, potentially. Given how long they last, given how much money that you have to put all the money in at the beginning, you kind of earn it back over a long period of time. The good news is, that supply is very stable. The bad news is that you're going to have to be able to have a business that can withstand a future of uncertainty in both price and a future that's going to have to manage carbon a lot better than we do today. So I don't know how you can go into building an infrastructure that's going to last 100 years and not deal with the carbon problem. You absolutely have to do it at the front. Otherwise, you're exposed for an extremely long period of time. It's not like doing something where you're going to do it and you're going to be done in 5 years. You're going to do it and you're going to live with it for a century. That changes, I think, the whole view about carbon management, about infrastructure management, and fundamentally about the way you run your businesses. And that's the last point. Sustainable business models. One would argue, from direct experience, that the shale oil business model developed in the late 70s was not a sustainable business model. It could not withstand the downturn which came. Now, most people are not talking about downturns in prices, you know, these days. But quite frankly, nobody's been all that great at predicting oil prices over the years. Things happen. So whatever business model you put in place, you've got to be sustainable. This is a characteristic that I like to tell students when I give talks at business schools. This is a big difference between the software business and the energy business. One, you put in all this money and you live with the thing because it's there every day. The second thing is, if you don't like it, you can't just go to the store and change it out. You have to live with it. You have to keep it. The ability of businesses to withstand high volatility in pricing, which is part of the energy business, to be able to withstand uncertainties in political and geopolitical consequences, and the ability to manage through changes in environmental expectations are all part of staying in this business. And with these longer resources, it's more important than ever. So with that, I look forward to your questions. Thank you.
Don, thank you. Thank you very much. Now we move to Ken Roberts, who will be talking about Centrolium FT process and fuels. Ken joined Centrolium in 1997 as business development manager. He was appointed vice president, planning and administration, and chief financial officer in 2002. He has over 25 years of petroleum industry experience and has supported several project development efforts for clients worldwide. So, Ken, thank you very much for joining us. We're delighted that you're here.
Thank you very much, Eric, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning. I would like to maybe say that I think my presentation is going to dovetail very nicely with Carl and Donald. In fact, one of the slides that Donald had, I think I'd like to borrow that from you. I have some similar ones here. Centrolium is a small technology company based in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And what I'd like to talk to you about a little bit this morning is the challenges to bring new technology to market. It doesn't happen just overnight. And I'd like to give you perspective from Centrolium's point of view. We've been in this business for almost 20 years in research and development in the Fischer Tropes area. And I'd like to just kind of give you an overview of what it took for us to get here and what it's going to take for us to get to a commercial plant in the future with the industry. Centrolium provided fuels for the Washington Metropolitan Transit Authority last summer for a three-month road test. This was fuel that was made from our Catoosa facility in Tulsa, Oklahoma. We're the only Fischer Tropes fully integrated plant that has provided fuels in the U.S. This led to another success story for us. Back in September, we provided fuel that was used in the first successful B-52 test of Fischer Tropes fuel here in the U.S. And this didn't happen just overnight. In fact, the Fischer Tropes process, there's about 80 years of history. The chemistry was discovered back in the early 20s. First plants were in Germany. Sasol in South Africa made tremendous strides in pushing forward very large commercial size plants. But as Don mentioned, there has been significant amount of technological advances just in the last 10 or 15 years in catalysis. All of the work that has been done up through and including in the 80s has been what we would say government-supported, non-economic application of this technology. It's only with the energy imbalances and the technology advances that have happened just in the relatively last few years that is bringing this technology to commercial reality. As I mentioned, some of the early deployment of this technology was due to politics, not economics. Germany used it in World War II. They didn't have ready access to oil. They had a lot of coal. South Africa developed its energy industry around Fischer Tropes because of the embargoes during the apartheid era. And I think that what we're seeing now is a combination of availability of some low-cost fossil fuels with advancement of technology that's allowing us to move the Fischer Tropes processes into commercial reality. But we still have some hurdles to overcome. Our president and CEO, Jack Holmes, likes to say that everybody wants to be the first to build the second plant. That first plan is very difficult. The bankers are very conservative, and they want to see a lot of this technology demonstrated at all the different scales, as Don mentioned, before they're ready to go forward. It does require high oil prices. It is a very expensive technology, so it does require a relatively low feedstock. From the banker's point of view, it's also going to take long-term offtake agreements, we believe. And I think the technology providers, all of us in the industry, and there's several of us working to try to bring this industry to commercial reality, they must have demonstrated the know-how and have successful operating experience, process guarantees for us to go forward. And I think the government, particularly in the U.S., policy discussions that have occurred are important drivers for the Fischer Tropsch industry in the U.S. We've talked about the early dependence, the try to minimize the dependence on foreign oil. We want to utilize our large domestic coal reserves that was mentioned earlier. The U.S. has over 270 billion tons of coal, and the topic of locating these plants near the source of the resource, and again, that transportation logistics and the supply chain is very important. The government policy side, we're also looking to enhance national security by dispersing domestic supply sources. Not only are we talking about Middle East issues and fragile supply chain from that region, but as we saw Hurricane Rita and Hurricane Katrina, both caused a significant disruption in supply because of the high concentration of our energy supplies from the U.S. Gulf Coast. And also from a government standpoint, we're also looking at job creation, and some of the policies and legislation has been passed here in the last couple of years has encouraged the industry from this point of view as well. So in order to commercially deploy this technology, it requires technology, patents, know-how, and demonstration. It requires substantial research and development expenditures over a long period of time. People, facilities, focus programs. Centrolium has spent over $250 million of research and development over the last 15 to 20 years. We have significant technical facilities, testing laboratories, pilot plants, scalable demonstration plant. We've also had third-party validation of this process and products. The process modeling, engineering, technology audits. We've also worked with various laboratories, the Department of Energy and Department of Defense, to verify the product quality and demonstrate both at a lab scale and road test scale. One of the challenges for a small company like Centrolium is that we're not Exxon, we're not Chevron, and so it's not that the bankers will take us by our word. We have to demonstrate. In fact, we feel like sometimes we have to go the extra mile, if you will, to demonstrate our technology, and we've done that. Over the last 15 years or so, we've had several pilot plants that have been operating in the Tulsa area. Their first pilot plant was demonstrated in the early 90s that we did on our own with shareholders. Texaco, one of our licensees in the early years, helped us in development of the Tulsa pilot plant that's there. ARCO Oil and Gas Company, which was a licensee, it's now BP, helped in funding and developing with us this Cherry Point demonstration plant in Washington State. We've also had a new advanced slurry reactor that was built in Tulsa back in the early 2000, and our most recent facility, the Catoosa demonstration facility, 70 barrels per day, was built with the support of the Department of Energy as well as Marathon Oil. So this has been a very much collaborative effort of industry and government in pushing this technology forward. Centrolium's legacy has been in gas to liquids. Most of our research area has been air-based Fischer tropes, where we're using air versus oxygen in an autothermal reformer, and then to Fischer tropes reactor using cobalt catalyst to create long-chain paraffin molecules that can be further upgraded into ultra-clean diesel and other fuels. We've been focusing on the last couple of years on transforming that technology into the coal-to-liquids business. And this basically is using a gasification process. Centrolium does not have gasification technology, but our research shows that the Fischer-Tropsch reactor doesn't really care where the molecules came from. Once we have synthesis gas, which is hydrogen and carbon monoxide, those are the basic building blocks for a lot of different chemicals. Our Fischer-Tropsch reactor really doesn't know whether it came from biomass or coal or pet coke or natural gas. We're able to convert those molecules, transform those molecules in the transportation fuels. So this is a diagram that is similar to what Donald showed a little bit earlier. It really takes a long time period of doing not just lab-scale pilot plant and demonstration to get to a commercial design, but integration and feedback loop. Quite often we'll learn something in the lab that you then have to demonstrate in the pilot plant and then a scale-up design. And as you discover things in each of those processes, it also causes you maybe to go back to the laboratory to investigate other engineering aspects or technical aspects that you have learned in any of the other processes. But the point is that from a pilot, from a laboratory scale, it takes hundreds of thousands of hours, hundreds of tests in facilities. And, continuous stir reactors, a laboratory, those are fairly simple. There's hundreds of those laboratories around the world and universities. But you can't do it all in the laboratory. It requires pilot plant scale. And if you look at, well, who in the world has built in pilot plants in the Fischer-Tropsch area, it's probably less than 10 that have done that. It takes tens of thousands of hours of running those pilot plants. If you then look at a demonstration scale plant, and Donald mentioned about hundreds of millions of dollars, that's what it takes to build that scale of plant, and there's probably less than 5 that have been operated in the world. So this is what it takes, and quite a daunting task for a small technology company. But we've done that. We have the laboratory scale facilities, one of the largest of such facilities in the U.S. We've got 19 bench scale reactor tests. We've developed and looked at over 1,000 different formulations of catalyst in our life. We've got over 1 million hours of runtime at the laboratory scale. And have developed not only a commercial catalyst, but also regeneration of catalyst procedures at the laboratory. At the 2-barrel-per-day pilot plant in Tulsa, Oklahoma, we have shown integration of autothermal reformer and multi-stage Fischer-Tropsch reactors. This is the facility that demonstrated and produced some of our first fuels that we've been able to provide to universities, Department of Energy, and Department of Defense. We've got over 36,000 hours of runtime to demonstrate catalyst life in a larger scale-up facility. The 70-barrel-per-day demonstration facility at Catoosa, which is near Tulsa, it's a fully integrated operation. We've got 2 slurry reactors. We've demonstrated the process that allows us to scale up to commercial-sized plant. These reactors are commercial height. They're about 1/10 the diameter of what a commercial reactor would look like. We've developed a lot of the technology that will allow us to go up into to a scale up of a commercial plant. Filtering of catalyst, heat material balance issues that would allow us to understand the scale up issues. We've produced over 500,000 gallons of Fischer-Tropsch fuels at this facility. We've demonstrated our autothermal reformer and Fischer-Tropsch reactors, and we now have a detailed mechanical design of our Fischer-Tropsch reactor based on our performance here at the plant. And it, as I mentioned earlier, it's the only fully integrated Fischer-Tropsch plant that is operated in the United States. A lot of you are familiar with the Fischer-Tropsch fuels. They're zero sulfur, zero aromatics, a cetane number of 74, and they're biodegradable. They can be placed in the existing infrastructure, transported, can be blended with diesel, conventional diesel, sold in existing markets, and this is an advantage of this fuel. From the military standpoint, it also has some very interesting characteristics, not just the low emissions, but very high thermal stability. It's also endothermic, which allows it to be used as a coolant, particularly in high-altitude jets like the SR-71 jet. Centrolene fuels have also been delivered worldwide. We've documented the high quality and performance. The Department of Defense, the Department of Energy have tested these fuels. We've had programs of testing with Daimler Chrysler and Toyota and Volkswagen, Japan Automotive Research Institute, and various universities here. I mentioned earlier about the road tests that we've done on our fuels with the Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Transit Authority, Denali National Park. Pikes Peak Hill Climb Race is another one that we've done. Tulsa Metro Transit is operating on Centrolene fuel today. We've got one bus that has been operating for about 6 months under the DOE's Ultra Clean Fuel Program and the Department of Transportation programs. And I mentioned to you the Air Force has also tested this in the B-52 flight tests. Delivery of the fuels, and again, part of this program is to demonstrate to the market what these fuels are capable of. So it's not only demonstrating the technology from a process standpoint, but helping the market and get to market acceptance of these fuels. We started delivering fuels to the U.S. auto industry for testing back in 1999. We've also delivered not only diesel fuel, but also synthetic base oils to the auto industry, and focusing as well on the military aspects of this fuel. Some of the early delivery of fuels to the Tankham Automotive Command Center in Warren, Michigan, and now we've been working with Wright-Patterson Air Force Base on providing fuels for that program as well. I mentioned to you earlier that Centrolium and its shareholders have spent over $250 million bringing the technology along. That's a pretty big number for a small company. It may be a drop in the bucket for Chevron or Exxon, but that's a pretty big number for us. But we also would like to acknowledge the fact that we've also received a significant support from the U.S. government. Over the years, about $25 million of support for this technology development, both from the commercial aspect as well as the military aspect of the fuel. We believe that the test flight of the B-52 bomber back in September was a significant event for Centrolium as well as the Department of Defense. This is a test in which there was a 50-50 blend of Centrolium Fischer-Tropsch fuel along with conventional JP-8 fuel. Again, this didn't happen overnight. There's been a long history of supplying test quantities of fuel to the military before we were able to reach this actual test flight. There's another test flight that I believe is coming up this month, if not this week, where all eight engines of the B-52 will be flying on a 50-50 blend of JP-8 and Centrolium fuel. And there'll be a cold start testing program sometime later next year, early next year. So, kind of summary, where are we going from here? We've made significant investments over the last 20 years. It's not easy bringing a technology such as this to commercial reality. And it has been an effort that is not only Centrolium shareholders, but a collaboration as well with the U.S. government. And we congratulate and appreciate the support that we've received from the DOE and the DOD in their leadership role in pushing this technology forward. We recognize that we have a responsibility as an industry. We're on the verge of commerciality in this country, and we can't afford to have an early failure. So everybody is being very careful to make sure that we have demonstrated the technology and ready to go forward with commercial plants. We think that the Department of Defense has created some momentum in this country for, you know, through their certification program of these fuels. But these are very expensive plants. You're talking about multiple billion dollars. And the bankers are still going to require long-term offtake to get financing for these projects. And I think it's going to take a collaborative effort both with the industry, the technology providers, and the government to be able to bring these technologies to the U.S. and commercial plants in a timely and economic manner. So thank you very much.
Ken, thank you very much. We now move to Dr. Robert Williams, who is a senior research scientist at the Princeton Environmental Institute, where he heads the Energy Systems Policy Analysis Group and the Carbon Capture Group under the Institute's Carbon Mitigation Initiative. He was trained as a physicist, and he joined Princeton's University Center for Energy and Environmental Studies in 1975. And the Institute in 2001. He has co-authored and or edited 13 major books and many journal articles and book chapters on a wide range of energy systems and topics and, thereof. So it's with great pleasure, Dr. Williams, that I introduce you.
Thank you. I'm going to give you a bit of a shift of course here, and I probably give a more technical talk than the previous ones, and my slides are going to be pretty dense, and I apologize for that, but the idea that I'm going to present is a little bit complicated, and I think I need this kind of detail. But what I'm going to be talking about is a strategy for simultaneously dealing with the oil security concerns and the climate concerns and the economic concerns about making synfuels. And I'm going to be focused on biomass, but biomass used with coal in making essentially Fischer-Tropsch liquids with ultra-low greenhouse gas emissions associated with both the conversion facility and the ultimate use of the burning of the liquid fuels. And I'm going to do this by focusing on exploitation of two very different carbon storage mechanisms simultaneously. So the outline of my presentation, I'm first going to present what I call the biofuels dilemma associated with conventional biofuels, and then introduce this two-part photosynthetics carbon storage strategy for addressing this dilemma. I will briefly describe alternative coal and coal biomass plants for making these Fischer-Tropsch liquids. I will focus a little bit on the characteristics of these plants, including their greenhouse gas emission rates. Then I'm going to focus on some very innovative research that was reported in the current issue of Science Magazine, based on work of David Tillman at the University of Minnesota, pioneering research on growing mixed prairie grasses as a biomass feedstock with enormous amounts of soil and root carbon storage. And then I'm going to talk about the implications of this proposed synfuel strategy for biodiversity loss concerns. I'll give you a brief economic analysis of synfuel production exploiting this two-part photosynthetic storage opportunity, and then I'll make some suggestions on how we might get on underway with this activity. The biofuels dilemma relates to a sharp contrast between the benefits of biofuels and its limitations on the Plus side, we have carbon neutrality via photosynthetic CO2 removal from the atmosphere and the renewability of the biomass source. On the downside, the very low efficiency of photosynthesis implies very large amounts of land, so that conventional biofuels can satisfy only part of the liquid fuel demand, even with improved conversion technologies. And as important as this, I think, and not nearly discussed as much, is biodiversity loss concerns about high levels of development of monoculture crops grown for energy purposes. And the two-part storage strategy for carbon that I'm going to present to you for addressing this dilemma is to shift biomass from being a carbon-neutral energy source to one that is strongly carbon-negative by means of this two-part strategy. And the first part of this strategy is based on biomass conversion via gasification involves separating out and storing underground in geological formations as CO2 most of the biomass not needed in the final energy products. And this part of the strategy is made economically interesting by co-processing this biomass with coal to make synfuels with carbon capture and storage in very large conversion plants, which is not feasible with conventional biomass plants. And the important point is that the negative CO2 emissions from photosynthetic CO2 storage offset coal CO2 emissions from the plant and from the eventual release of CO2 to the atmosphere from coal as a result of synfuel combustion. And the second part of this carbon storage strategy is to grow biomass as mixed prairie grasses on carbon-depleted soils, which leads to substantial additional storage of photosynthetic CO2 as soil carbon and root carbon. And the second part of this strategy, focusing on mixed prairie grasses, also addresses very effectively the biodiversity challenge that is posed by conventional biofuels. And some of the key quantitative aspects of this bio-C storage strategy are, first of all, that up to 90% of the carbon in the biomass can be routinely stored underground as CO2, along with CO2 derived from coal if the biomass and coal are gasified to make synfuels and electricity. And this is reported in a paper, if you're interested, that we presented at the GHGT8 conference in Trondheim, Norway, this last June. And secondly, if biomass that is used in these conversion processes are these mixed prairie grasses that are grown on carbon-depleted soils, which means cultivated land, then the biomass growth would be accompanied by carbon buildup in the soils and roots at rates that are up to 60% of the carbon in the harvested biomass. And this is reported in this article that was just published last week in Science Magazine, an effort led by David Tillman at the University of Minnesota. And so in sum, you can store underground carbon amounting to up to 150% of the carbon in the harvested biomass. And this two-element carbon storage strategy makes it feasible for biomass to play much greater role in mitigating climate change than with any conventional biofuel, whether you're talking about cellulosic ethanol or biodiesel or whatever you want to think about. This is fundamentally different. And it will enable you to do so without biodiversity loss concerns posed by conventional biofuels that are based on growing monocultures. And to begin this, I'm going to start and look at various systems for making Fischer-Tropsch fuels plus electricity from coal with CO2 vented. And I'm going to focus on once-through processes that pass the synthesis gas through the synthesis reactor once and take the unconverted syngas and use it to make electricity as a major co-product. And I will assert, and you can go back to our GHGT8 paper to see the details of this, that in a climate-constrained world where the electricity value is essentially equal to that of a IGCC plant with carbon capture and storage, these once-through plants that make both liquid fuels and electricity will be the most economical plants for making liquid fuels if you can sell the electricity into the market at a competitive price. And if you use low-cost Western coal, such plants can provide fuels that can compete with diesel and gasoline derived from crude oil priced at somewhere in the range $40 to $50 a barrel. A problem with this particular strategy is that the CO2 emissions, if you vent the CO2, which has to be recovered upstream of synthesis, even if you're not concerned about climate change, would be up to about 1.8 times the greenhouse gas emission rate for crude oil-derived hydrocarbon fuels. And in a climate-constrained world, this is going to be unacceptable. Fortunately, there are substantial opportunities for carbon capture and storage. I'm not going to dwell on this. I quote here some of the primary conclusions of the IPCC's report on carbon capture and storage that was released in 2005, and I was a lead author contributing to this report, and I'm not going to go through these points here. You can read this in my presentation at your leisure afterward. If you do carbon capture and storage for this FT fuels plus electricity plant, then you can reduce the greenhouse gas emission rate for the Fischer-Tropsch liquids down to a level that's just slightly higher than that for crude oil-derived hydrocarbon fuel, and for the electricity, the greenhouse gas emission rate would be essentially the same as that for a coal IGCC plant with carbon capture and storage. I would like to assert here that if we get into the synfuels business, it is going to be very important that we strive to adopt policies that will enable no synfuel plant ever being built without carbon capture and storage. And there are several practical reasons why this is important. First of which is that the incremental cost of carbon capture is much less for a synfuel plant than it is for an IGCC plant or any coal power plant. In fact, for a synfuel plant that makes only liquid fuels, operating in the recycled mode, the cost of capture is essentially the cost of CO2 compression. Okay, so all you have to pay for is the CO2 compression cost, transport and storage cost to put it away. And this makes the CO2 available at synfuels plants very attractive for use in EOR applications. And in fact, if you have a recycled synfuels plant, every barrel of synfuels that you produce would support about 2 incremental barrels of CO2 EOR by means of if you could have a site for EOR that is nearby. Another very practical reason for insisting that no plant be built without carbon capture and storage is if you don't have such a requirement, it's going to be very difficult to get very many plants built very fast, and we're not going to be able to build an industry very rapidly because there will be court cases for essentially every power plant, every synfuels plant that comes along. A problem with this particular configuration is that in a climate-constrained world, liquid fuels characterized by near-zero greenhouse gases emissions will be needed. And so we must do much better than just doing carbon capture and storage for coal Fischer-Tropsch fuels. And one way to do that is to combine the coal with some biomass feedstock for these particular plants. And the biomass can be either residues of agricultural, forest product industry residues, or dedicated energy crops. And combine this in a system with carbon capture and storage so as to exploit the negative CO2 emissions potential of storing photosynthetic CO2 in geological formations to offset the CO2 emissions from the plant and eventually from the eventual Fischer-Tropsch fuel combustion. Co-processing with coal and biomass leads to low emissions at low cost. And the reason why I stress low cost is because you can do a couple of things. One is you can exploit the scale economies of coal conversion, which are not possible with biomass alone, and you can also exploit the fact that the cost of coal is typically very low, much lower than the cost of the biomass. And simultaneously, you can exploit with these systems under a carbon policy the negative emissions potential of the biomass, and under a carbon policy, these negative emissions will be highly valued, as I will show you. The problem with this particular strategy, and notice I have here 2 separate gasifiers. Why do I have two separate gasifiers? You can do it in the same gasifier. And in fact, we have experience with co-processing of coal and biomass with the Bougenem IGCC plant in the Netherlands. If you're going to pursue the strategy that I've outlined here, which is to grow mixed prairie grasses as a primary feedstock, the basic idea is to do this with very low emission or very low inputs of fertilizer, pesticides, and all of that. And if you're going to do that, you'll want to return to the fields the dry ash recovered from the gasification process. And if you mix the biomass ash with the coal ash, you cannot do that. So in the near term, you can start off with co-gasification in the same gasifier as we're doing, say, at Bougenem. But in the longer term, you're going to want to have two separate gasifiers. And the fly in the ointment here is that, in contrast to the coal case, we don't yet have a large-scale biomass commercial gasifier of the size needed. But that technology could be brought to market in a period of 5 to 10 years if there were sufficient market interest. Going beyond what I showed you before, I have in the previous graph, I showed this underground storage of CO2 here, supercritical CO2 over there. In the case of the use of mixed prairie grasses, you're also storing soil and root carbon underground associated with the production of this biomass. And this two-carbon storage strategy leads to much larger role for biomass in mitigating climate change than is feasible with any conventional biofuel strategy. And I'll show you now some characteristics of these particular technologies. These two bars up here represent the greenhouse gas emission rate in kilograms of carbon equivalent per gigajoule of liquid fuel. This is for gasoline and diesel fuel derived from crude oil. This is for coal. Fischer-Tropsch liquids with CO2 vented. You can see the greenhouse gas emission rate goes up about 80%. If you do carbon capture and storage for coal Fischer-Tropsch liquids, the greenhouse gas emission rate drops to about the rate for gasoline and diesel. If you do coal biomass Fischer-Tropsch liquids in a system that has about 28% biomass, you can reduce the greenhouse gas emission rate by about a factor of 4. And this is one based on switchgrass, which is a monoculture, and I'm assuming here no soil and root carbon buildup, which is a major finding in the Tillman study, that monocultures lead to very little net soil and carbon sequestration. And of course, if I added more biomass as a fraction of the total fuel input, you could reduce this further. I show in the last bar here is essentially zero net emissions. What I've done in this case is I'm exploiting both the CO2, supercritical CO2 storage, and the soil and root carbon storage, and asked how much biomass do you need in this system to give zero net greenhouse gas emissions for the liquid fuels. And it's 21% biomass in a plant that makes essentially 14,000 barrels per day of synthetic liquid fuels plus 450 megawatts of electricity co-product. This graph here shows how much biomass you need to make 1 gigajoule of carbon-neutral liquid fuel. The first graph is for the system that I just described to you, and it requires 2/3 of a unit of biomass to make 1 unit of liquid fuel that is carbon-neutral. And I compare that to what the amount of biomass you need to make 1 unit of liquid fuel from 3 different variants of cellulosic ethanol technology. This is cellulosic ethanol vintage 2000, vintage 2015 as projected by NREL, and vintage 2030 as projected by Lee Lint and his collaborators at Dartmouth. And what you can see is that even with this futuristic technology, you would need 3 times as much biomass as with this co-processing strategy to make 1 unit of liquid fuel. That's very important from the point of view of the farmer, because the farmer is going to have much more market power in selling his biomass to make these liquid fuels with these co-processing strategies than with any conventional biofuel. So the farmer should be very interested in this. This is the Tillman Experimental Station at Cedar Creek in Minnesota. Each of those plots is a 9-by-9-meter plot in which he's been experimenting with various numbers of mixed grass species ranging all the way from 1 up to 32 species. And he's found some very interesting results, one of which is that the yields of biomass, sustainable yields, increase monotonically with the number of species. And also, you get a sustained buildup of soil put plus root carbon that is also increases strongly monotonically with the number of species. And instead of getting biodiversity loss with these mixed species, you actually have local biodiversity gain with these strategies. And this is a very important point with regard to this growing concern about biodiversity loss associated with monocultures. And this probably means that not only would cellulosic ethanol be able to provide much less low greenhouse gas emitting liquid fuel than would propose coal biomass Fischer Tropsch strategy, but also its potential might be constrained by these biodiversity loss concerns. Although converting any into useful fuel, any heterogeneous feedstock like biodiversity-enhancing mixed prairie grass is always more challenging than for homogeneous feedstocks. The challenging is far less daunting for thermochemical conversion by means of gasifications than for biological conversions such as fermentation to ethanol. And therefore, gasification conversion route might prove to be key in addressing effectively the biodiversity loss challenge posed by conventional biofuels such as ethanol, which are likely to be based on monoculture feedstocks. Now I'm going to give you a very brief internal rate of return analysis to show what the prospective economics would be. And I'm going to focus on one of the worst environments you can think of for growing biomass. I'm going to think about growing prairie grasses in Montana. Why is that the worst environment? It's the worst environment because Montana is almost a desert. But it's also the home of some of the cheapest coal in the United States, and it's likely to be a place where the initial synfuels plants will be built. And we have done an economic analysis of this that involves both very low-cost coal, where the coal price is less than half of the national average coal price, and the delivered price of the biomass, which I'm going to assume here for this analysis, 8 times as expensive as the coal price. Okay, per gigajoule. The biomass is 8 times as expensive. And I'm also going to look at this in a world with $100 a ton carbon price. Why $100 a ton carbon price? Because that is the minimum price that's needed with current technology for a coal IGCC plant with carbon capture and storage in an with aquifer disposal. And if we don't have a carbon price of the order of $100 a ton or more, we're probably not going to solve the climate problem. So I think it's useful to think of $100 a ton of carbon. I'm also going to be looking at CO2 storage here in saline formations that are 100 miles from the conversion plant and look at the economics as a function of the oil price. This is the internal rate of return here as a function of the oil price. I show, and this is for $100 a ton of carbon in these two prices that I've assumed. Where do I get this biomass price? I got the biomass price by assuming that under these conditions, in a world with $40 a barrel oil, that a pure coal synfuels plant that also makes electricity and as a major co-product and a coal biomass plant sell their liquid fuel and their electricity at exactly the same price. Okay? And then I asked, what would the converter be willing to pay for the biomass in order to bring about this equality? And the answer is he'd be willing to pay 8 times as much for the biomass as for the coal. Okay? And that turns out, as I'll show you in a minute, to be a very nice price as far as the farmer is concerned. And you can see that for under these conditions, this system with $40 a barrel oil would be able to provide synthetic liquid fuel with net zero greenhouse gas emissions for about $1.40 a gallon of gasoline equivalent. Why is it possible to have this situation when the market price is 8 times the coal price in this situation? The reason this works is because we are assigning value to the greenhouse gas emissions, okay? And you can see that if you assign those emissions to the coal in the feedstock, its price essentially triples its effective price triples when you take into account all the emissions that are associated with coal. Whereas in the case of the biomass, its effective price, taking into account these negative emissions, is only half of the effective price of the coal, despite the fact that its market price is eight times as large. Notice here also that the payment to the farmer is very high. It's on the order of $35 to $40 a ton. And about 70% of the payment to the farmer is associated with his building up the soil and root carbon. Okay, so that's very important. That makes this profitable for the farmer, even though the yields in Montana here are about 1.2 dry tons per acre per year of the of the of the biomass, which is extremely low level. Finally, how can you bring about such a future? I think one of the highest priorities here is we need incentives for commercializing biomass gasification technologies because, unlike the situation with coal, we don't have a commercial gasifier at the same time. We also need a major R&D initiative for biomass production on carbon-depleted soils, and I think we need both state programs and supplemental federal support, and I think that a key policy focus here should be the 2007 Farm Bill. We need to encourage coal biomass co-processing with carbon capture and storage as a major activities in the Great Plains. We need a policy to facilitate development of infrastructure for biomass harvesting, storage, and transport for energy. Of course, we shouldn't be focusing exclusively on the supply side here. We could make the whole challenge much easier if we also promoted the fuel economy for motor vehicles, for example, some new variant of a CAFE standard. And we, of course, need a climate change mitigation policy for transportation fuels. And I'm talking here not just about cap and trade, which I think is not going to get us on the course we need sooner, but we need some kind of requirement that no coal synfuel plant should be built without carbon capture and storage, and we need something like a low-carbon obligation for fuels that would be modeled after the renewable portfolio standard. And then we shouldn't just think about this as a U.S. strategy, but we should also think about launching a global initiative for low-intensity biomass production on carbon-depleted lands involving especially, I think, China, where there are huge amounts of degraded grasslands that account for about 40% of the land area of China. And there's a pressing need to make China's emerging coal synfuels program climate friendly.
Robert, thank you very much. We now turn for comments and reflections to our friend Doug Arendt, who is Director of Strategic Analysis at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, where he specializes in strategic planning and financial analysis competencies, clean energy technologies, and energy and water issues, international and governmental policies. Doug, from my standpoint, you'll need to weave together advantageous interdependence, molecular readjustment, carbon negativity, polyculture mandate, and then somehow you'll have to build in synthetic B-52s. So over to you.
Thanks, Eric. I don't know about the synthetic B-52 piece of it, but the other ones I think we'll make some progress on. I wanted to take just a couple of minutes to reflect back and provide some context because this is the fifth session in our series, and we started the series with the specific goal in mind to help inform the policy debate around future fuels, around the transportation sector. I think we've in some sense come back to the future. We started with an overview. We've gone down a biofuels pathway for a couple of different sessions. We've looked at some alternative technologies, including the demand side of the equation. And today we've been, I think, blessed with a very strong panel who have presented a breadth of technology options, but also a very, I would call it, even-handed analysis of the potential as well as the challenges. And I think bringing some of those to bear in some reflective comments and then going to your questions, I think, is worthy of a minute or two. Eric captured a couple of the key takeaways. Molecular transformation, advantageous interdependence, clearly. I think the other big piece to really think about, whether or not one's thinking about carbon to liquids in terms of many of the technologies and the fuel sources that we talked about today, including biofuels, is the transformation from distillation to synthetics. I think it was a very key point, and it brings with it a number of significant both policy challenges as well as commercial challenges. And one of the biggest ones is the movement to from concentrated sources to distributed sources, and what that requires in terms of investment and in terms of time frame. And I think that pulls us really full circle when we think about the last comments from Dr. Williams in terms of the climate challenge, because the three principal drivers that we continue to talk about are economics, continue to support economic development, economic growth, environmental challenges, and I think if you now start to think about a carbon policy more distinctly, and the trade-offs between economics and carbon policy, and then security, and now we build in the domestic resources versus the geopolitical resources and what this institution is all about. One has to think very carefully about what is the policy environment which will allow the investment to flow, and those investments are enormous, as we heard about, and they require a significant amount of time in order to return the investment to the shareholders. And that is a very, very significant challenge when the typical policy debate is about what can you deliver to me here and now today or here and now within the next election cycle. And so I think given those reflective comments, I'll turn to you for some additional questions. Eric, I think you've probably got some ground rules there, but
I do.
We'll
I
go
do.
From there and look forward to your questions.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thanks, Doug. Now let's turn to you for your comments, your reactions, for your questions. I ask a couple things. The first is that you identify yourself, that you identify your affiliation, whatever that may be, and that you keep your comments short. Let's make sure that we make this as transactional as possible. You can imagine the challenge from this side with four panelists and a commentator that will try to pack as much by way of reaction as we possibly can on our side. So with that, I open the floor for comment and reaction. In the front, please. Would you please wait till the microphone arrives, too, please?
Hello. Hi. My name is Paul, and I'm with the Arlington Institute. This question is for Mr. Roberts or Mr. Williams. I've heard that when you gasify coal, the byproducts are extremely toxic, and so that would have ramifications for syn fuels and for IGCC technology. So can either of you comment on that?
When you gasify coal to make either electricity or syn fuels, you remove the toxic materials ahead of synthesis, okay, in the synthesis reactor, and there the pollutants are very concentrated relative to what they would be if you burned the coal and you had to remove the pollutants from the flue gases and the syn gas from which you remove the these toxic materials is also very high pressure. And so you have very high partial pressures, very high concentrations, and it's very easy to remove these to very high levels in a gasification-based system as opposed to a combustion-based system. In addition to that, you also have the constraint that the synthesis catalysts are very sensitive to trace impurities. And so even if you didn't have these environmental concerns to worry about, you would have to, for example, reduce the H2S levels to extremely low levels just to meet the needs of the catalysts. And the catalysts are actually more sensitive here than the environment is. So if you meet the demands of the catalyst, you meet the demands of the environment automatically. And one of the important concerns, a new concern, you know, with regard to coal combustion is mercury buildup in the atmosphere. We've gone beyond the criteria pollutants to include that, and mercury controls are going to be much tougher in the future. And the interesting thing is that mercury removal upstream of conversion in either an electricity plant or in a synfuels plant can be accomplished at extremely low incremental cost. In fact, it's so low that it's hardly noticeable in the overall cost of production.
But how would you dispose of the
concentrated? Oh, and the other thing is that in train flow gasifiers, which dominate the production, what you produce is the ash is recovered as a glassy non-leachable slag, okay, and that non-leachable slag can be, in fact, used for road fill and other purposes of that nature. So the toxic materials, many of the toxic materials, other than mercury, for example, are trapped in this slag.
Would anyone
else? I just might mention. I'll reiterate the issue of needing to clean the syngas before you get to Fischer Tropsch. The level of contaminants needs to be down into the 50 parts per billion level in order to avoid adverse deactivation issues with Centrolium or any of the Fischer Tropsch catalysts. And so that is an important part of the process.
Anyone else? No? Right here, please.
Hi there. Dana Wong, PFC Energy. My question is a short clarification for Donald Paul. In your barrels, 1,000 barrels per day and 15 million gallons per year, this is on the basis of energy density, I assume?
Just volume. So, you know, 42 gallons per barrel, 365 days. You just kind of multiply it out.
Basis. You don't have any kind of energy density comparison?
No. In other words, you have 1,000 barrels a day of ethanol is equivalent to 15 million gallons a year of ethanol. Okay. Same molecule.
In the back, let's check.
Hi, Ken Andrasco, Environmental Protection Agency. I have two related questions. The first is there's a bewildering array of technologies out there that we always hear about at these meetings. Do you think that we're likely to see the development of a couple of generic systems? It's going to shake down to a couple of generic systems that we can begin thinking about more seriously, like maybe coal gasification and some sort of biorefinery. And if so, how long is that likely to take, and when would we likely to see the first large-scale commercial Fischer Tropsch system?
Who would like to begin?
I'll just start. I mean, first off, large-scale Fischer Tropsch facilities are being built outside the United States. So I think your question was in the United States. Was that? Yeah. Okay. I don't know. Probably you other guys can say. I mean, I think you're going to see some plants over the next few years. But I think the question of that I would ask my fellow panelists who are experts in this is, when is the technology going to stabilize to the point that you're going to build more than a few? And I think that's a good question. If you think about refining technology as an analog, it took decades to stabilize to the complex refineries we have today that process challenging crude. So my guess is decades.
Carl, would you like to answer?
Yeah, I would suggest that there are several large companies now that have, for example, GE and the Chevron Texaco gasifier have merged around that enterprise. They are looking at standardization. One of the things that will drive standardization is multiple plants being built by the same entities or the same specifications. As long as it's a onesies, twosies marketplace, it's very hard and it will take decades. If there was a substantial, and what substantial is might be 10, plants being simultaneously built, it starts to bring in a commonality of performance. It also starts to allow a sorting by the marketplace of the best performance. And so it's kind of a chicken and egg almost. I think it'll pick up speed. And if you take, for example, the fact that Fischer Tropsch liquids, as Ken said, has been around a long time, There are some changes we're looking at ourselves. For example, the Fischer-Tropsch catalysts were all produced or designed when CO2 was not an issue. If you were to look at them now, would you come up with the same answer with CO2 as a valued commodity? What we're finding is maybe not exactly. Those things will also force design considerations. And then with several large plants being built, I would say simultaneously, they'll sort out and we'll be down to probably two or three major competitive designs like in many other areas of these large-scale plants. And as we were talking about earlier, Don, it's hard to grasp a plant that can take you a day to walk across its whole footprint, but that's what we're talking about. So this is a very complex problem with a lot of subsets, and so I think a broader demand will cause a more rapid movement to a single design or competing designs of similar capability, and the industry is already moving that way, I believe, from what I see.
I might just add, if I may, the time it takes to take from engineering, front-end engineering design, through construction to startup is in the range of 5 to 6 years. And currently, in my understanding, I don't know of any projects in the U.S. that are undergoing process design package and FEED at this time. There's several projects that are undergoing what we would call a detailed feasibility study in preparation to kick off that process, but you're still talking about 5 to 6 years from when you've got the sponsors, you've got the site, you've got the technology chosen, the technology has been demonstrated to the point of where you can take that to the next level. You're still talking about 5 to 6 years from now.
Let me
add one more thing is, with an increased number of IGCs looking like they're going to come forward and be built, actually, that will also help to address the standardization for Fischer-Tropsch liquids plants as well, because a large portion of the IGCC, gasifier at least, and that's a major portion, and related supporting systems are basically common to both applications. So then you wind up in the Fischer-Tropsch side of the plant where you wind up with the modifications, and so that will move things, I think, a little more rapidly.
Okay, right in the front here with the white shirt, please. Thanks.
My name is Jim Bartis. I'm with the Rand Corporation, and I have a question for Mr. Roberts. You showed on your one of your slides a large number of tests. You emphasized a lot of utilization tests, but at the same time, we've had major Fischer-Tropsch plants operating in Malaysia. Shell's building a huge plant, 140,000 barrels a day, I believe, in Qatar. Sasol already has plants up. They just built a brand new one in Qatar. And right now, aircraft are already allowed to fly using Fischer-Tropsch liquids in South Africa, and they're going towards 100%. So is there really a need to do any testing, end-use testing?
Well, I'd say that there's a lot of similarities in Fischer-Tropsch processes, and there's a lot of differences. The Shell process is a fixed tube reactor design. The Sasol technology is a slurry bubble column reactor. Sasol has both iron based catalyst as well as cobalt based catalyst. Their newest technology that they're applying in Qatar is cobalt based. And I think we're seeing the industry go towards cobalt, which is a higher cost per pound but lower life cycle cost. It also can be regenerated. So the industry is continuing to look to develop new catalyst formulations and to lower that capital cost. And I think the innovation that the industry is coming to is there will be competition as we all look to see how we can lower the capital cost and the operating costs and improve the catalysis systems.
I think you had a somewhat different question is what I took on it. I mean, is the fuels are going to be the fuels. And I think the development of standards for GTL fuels and standard markets is underway. And I think where my colleague was talking about is there's a lot of battling over the process technology and which one's going to win and provide the most stable margins and best return on capital, all those kinds of things. That's a different issue. But I think from at the customer interface, you're going to see these premium molecule markets materialize.
Good. In the back, please.
Tony Andrews with the Congressional Research Service. Gentleman from Centrolium, can you comment about the emission characteristics of the diesel that you're producing? Does it have any inherent advantage over conventional diesel in terms of its emissions, particularly particulate emissions, which is a major concern here? Low salt.
Well, all Fischer-Tropsch fuels are basically zero sulfur, zero aromatics. Some of the testing has shown significant reduction in particulates, NOx, in the range of 30 to 40%. There's a fairly wide range of body of information that the Department of Energy has put out that describes those fuels, but they are significantly lower emissions than conventional diesels.
All right. Oh, sorry.
I just wanted to make a comment here, and that is that when we make this transition to from distillation to synthesis as a basis for fuels production, I want to go back to Don Paul's initial comment, and that is you have an enormous amount of flexibility in producing the kind of fuel that you want. And the reason there's all this interest in Fischer-Tropsch liquids today is because among the synthetic fuel options, Fischer-Tropsch liquids is already commercially available. It's the furthest along among all the alternatives. But if we're going to make these massive investments in synthetic fuels plants, we want to make sure we're on the track toward the fuels that we will want in the future. And Fischer-Tropsch is not the only option. I will point out, for example, that an alternative fuel that is getting enormous amount of attention in China is dimethyl ether. Initially, it's going to be almost exclusively used as a LPG supplement for cooking, but China is also thinking about using DME as a transport fuel in compression ignition engine vehicles. And in fact, there is a fleet of Shanghai buses that's going to be run on DME in the next couple of years. And if that is successful, you can be sure that in China, you know, DME is going to become a major transportation fuel. It has some very attractive attributes as a fuel for use in compression ignition engines, both with regard to its cetane number and also with regard to its ability to get simultaneously low emissions of both particulates and NOx with very little end-of-pipe control technology. And this is probably not the end of the story. You can make anything you want out of these two molecules, CO and H2, and we should be spending a lot of time thinking about where we want to end up in terms of liquid fuels of the future before we get too committed to any one energy carrier.
Just a couple of comments on this. Determining how fuels are set and markets are set is actually quite complex. It isn't a matter of somebody saying, well, we're going to do A and then A happens. That's not actually how it works. Auto companies have a lot to do. We're seeing even regional fuels. And the other thing is that synthetic fuels are going to be part of the market, but oil-based fuels are going to dominate for a very long time. And so I think it's going to be a mixture. And actually how those markets mature and whether you end up with a highly fractionized market, which is possible based and essentially you already have that. You have that in the United States. California has a different fuel than everyone else. And so if you think globally how that's going to work out, I think it's complex. But Bob's right. You can make what you want from synthetic fuels, but synthetic fuels are going to have to exist with conventional fuels for a very long time as well, certainly on a global scale. So I think the evolution options are there. How it's actually going to evolve, I think, is going to be a very complex process.
All right. In the very back, please, Jeff.
Thank you. Carmen DeFilio, Department of Energy. With regard to technology learning and the confidence that investors get to move forward with more plants, is there any difference between plants that are built in foreign countries and plants that are built here? And if there are differences, why?
Well, maybe I'll try. There is a reason why Centroleum announced its first commercial size plant in eastern Germany. There's significant government support for that project, that program is a combination of technology related as well as jobs creation. On the other hand, you're also seeing a large number of Fischer-Tropsch coal-to-liquids plants being developed in China. That's being developed because of the huge need for new energy in China, and it is a national priority. And therefore, the programs that the Chinese government is pushing forward is to get those plants built as quickly as possible. So it's very much driven, I think, from a government policy standpoint, and why you're seeing some of those plants built in those locations sooner and more rapidly than you're seeing them developed here in the U.S.
Well, I would say it also, in China, the case is China has also massive coal reserves. So I think it's a combination of where's the resource, what is the resource cost, what's the infrastructure, a combination of that with the political environment, regulatory environment, estimated or perceived risk associated with capital investments by investment institutions. It's a complex mixture, and I don't think there's a blanket statement one way or the other. It depends very specifically on what kind of plant, what kind of feedstock.
Robert.
Yes. I'd like to make a comment about China with regard to the issue of dealing with the climate challenge. And there's an intense interest in trying to get China interested in doing IGCC power generation for coal-based electricity. And that's going at a real snail's pace in China. There's one IGCC plant that's been in the planning, you know, for more than a decade, and they're just building pulverized coal plants like crazy in China at the present time. And so it's like a runaway train. But on the other hand, the interesting thing is China is not a novice when it comes to gasification technology, modern gasification technology. It's probably more coal gasifiers, modern coal gasifiers in China than anywhere else in the world. But they're essentially all in the chemical process industry because their chemical process industry is based mainly on coal because they have scant oil and gas resources. And now there's this growing interest in synfuels in China. And as I pointed out in my presentation, if the electricity price is sufficiently high, as it would be under a climate constraint, these polygeneration plants that make both liquid fuels and electricity will make liquid fuels at a lower cost than a pure synfuels plant. Okay, and this is an important way of introducing gasification technology into the power sector by the backdoor route of doing it with these synfuels plants, which China is really interested in pursuing at a very aggressive pace.
Carlin, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, the only thing else I would add, and I will go back to his talk about China, they're also doing, we didn't talk today about it, but they're talking about the direct liquefaction process, and they're building plants for those over there, which provides a different cut at a liquid fuel from more towards the area of gasoline, actually, from coal. But with an indirect liquefaction, a direct liquefaction plant, you can deal with the environmental issues that our previous experience with direct liquefaction also hampers. Going back to the earlier question about standardization, because the number of plants being in China and because the fact that fabrication of these facilities requires substantial capacity, both in the size of the materials and the amount, which we don't seem to have the infrastructure in the United States to any degree anymore, that would be part of the answer to standardization. By default, what they learn there and what they do there will substantially impact the standardization process. I'm going to throw a little side thing in here. We didn't talk about water today, but all the things we talk about are very, not only greenhouse gas is an issue, but how you deal with where the water comes for every aspect of the process and how you deal with the effluents and all is also a major issue that has to be dealt with in all energy production as well as the biomass production for energy. So I just wanted to add that because we haven't mentioned it.
Thank you. Thank you. In the back, please.
Yes, Sam Hancock with the Eurasia Center. This is for Dr. Williams. With the emphasis on your research in Montana, talking about the various prairie grasses and the cheap cost of the coal, are there any plans there as far as federal and state policies to start building some plants that would combine all this and basically get at the model that you've developed in your research?
The governor of the state of Montana has become a real advocate of coal syn fuels, as many of you know. And more recently, he's gotten intrigued by this whole idea of co-processing with biomass as along with the coal. And his motivation for doing both the coal and the biomass is that he wants to promote economic development in Montana in the economically depressed areas. And the coal syn fuels opportunity promotes economic development in the southeastern part of the state, and the adding the biomass element spreads the economic benefits over all of the very poor farming areas, which are in the north, central, and northeastern parts of the state. And that economic motivation is really what has gotten him excited about this co-processing idea. But there is some legislation in the state that is in the making at the present time, focused, I believe, on developing a CO2 pipeline infrastructure for the coal syn fuels industry, but there's no law at the present time. But there's several things that are in the works.
Thank you.
Andy Patterson with EBI. Let me follow up on the incentives question. Maybe starting with Bob and then get Don's comments or the others about what incentives we're really going to need to get these plants, because I don't think $100 a ton, even with Senator Boxer at EPW, is going to be on the table. At most, we're seeing $7 to $10 being discussed by National Commission on Energy Policy and that. So one question is, what happens if you can really only get $7 to $10 a ton? And then, secondly, what is the set of incentives that this Congress should put on the table? Is it loan guarantees? Is it tax credits? What's the mix that gets plants done in this country? Because I don't think state incentives alone are going to have a deep enough wallet.
My own view is that a carbon cap and trade system, while it's as exemplified by the National Commission on Energy policy recommendations, is probably a good long-term strategy. It's not going to be nearly enough in the near term, and I think we need to complement this kind of economy-wide long-term strategy with sectoral policies. And one that I've given a lot of attention to in the power sector is a low-carbon obligation for coal electricity. And I'll explain what that is in a moment. And we need something similar to that, which is sort of a low-carbon obligation for liquid fuels or transport fuels. A low-carbon obligation for electricity, which has actually been discussed widely over the last year. There's a provision for it in the Jeffords climate bill, for example, would work like a renewable portfolio standard. And the basic idea would be to require that every retail provider of electricity have a growing fraction of decarbonized coal in her supply portfolio. She can either generate those decarbonized electrons herself, or she can buy them from merchant power producers, or buy low-carbon generation credits in a tradable credit market, just like for the renewable portfolio standard. You probably know that there are of the order of 20 states, if I'm right, Doug, on this, that have a renewable portfolio standard. And the renewable portfolio standard has been introduced and passed the Senate three times so far for a federal standard. Each time it has been knocked down in conference because the House has been opposed for it. And opposed to it, and I suspect that in the next 2 years we're going to see something like a renewable portfolio standard, and this is the time to bring in something like a low-carbon obligation for coal electricity. And by the way, the way the numbers work out on this is that the incremental cost of carbon capture and storage under this trading system is paid for by all ratepayers. And David Hawkins and I wrote a paper on this, and we show that the maximum penalty in the period out to 2020, if the obligation were such as to essentially cover all new expected coal power generation that would be built between now and between 2012, say, and 2020, the maximum increase in the retail price would be less than the annual fluctuation of the electricity retail electricity price, because you're spreading this over all, essentially, all ratepayers. And a low-carbon obligation for fuels would evolve in a similar manner, although that particular obligation is more difficult to work out in practice, and several people are working on it at the present time.
Well, I guess I have a somewhat different take on this as a fuel producing company. Our view is that if you get the technology right and you get the right business model, and then you produce fuels that are competitive with other fuels. And that is a stable business model. If the business models require a specific policy to exist, history has shown, at least, that policies change. And so I think our goal would be, in terms of government interaction in this area, would be to support the technology advancement and the demonstrations of the technology. I think that's how you drive to sustainable business models, that you get the right technology and the right capital. There is history where we have built the wrong capital because it had because of incentive programs, and then we're really quite unhappy with in the long pull. So our view is get the science right, get the engineering right, get the business model right, and we believe these fuels will compete in the future.
One very important point to keep in mind is with regard to this whole issue of climate change mitigation and carbon capture and storage, and that is that retrofits are always more expensive than greenfield plants when you do this. And if you're building a power plant or a syn-fuels plant, these plants are going to be designed to operate over a period of the order of half a century, and that's a long-term commitment. And it would be desirable to put these climate change mitigation policies in place a priori before we even get a carbon price of the order of $100 a ton in place, because it would eliminate a lot of the uncertainty, and it would also facilitate the rapid expansion of the industry by bringing on a lot of the stakeholders who are going to be very troubled if we don't deal with this climate problem associated with syn-fuels production. It's very different from the electricity case in the sense that the emission rate almost doubles relative to conventional crude oil-derived hydrocarbon fuels. And that would be a terrible precedent if we got into a situation of generating a lot more greenhouse gas emissions than we have been historically. I should point out that if we're going to solve the climate problem, we got to address both coal and oil problems, or liquid fuels problem, because coal and liquid fuels each account for about 40% of global greenhouse gas emissions, or global CO2 emissions from fossil fuel burning at the present time. And we've got to find ways to bring about deep reductions in emissions for both of those if we're going to have a prayer of a chance of stabilizing atmospheric CO2 at, say, less than a doubling of the pre-industrial concentration.
We've had some very patient individuals in the front here. I think we have time for only two more questions. If we could be brief, staccato, I'd be grateful.
I'm Adam Sarvino with Inside EPA. It's kind of an open question for the panel, although I'd like Mr. Roberts to maybe start. What do you guys predict in terms of climate regulations versus developments in sequestration technology? Do you think that's going to be an issue in the short term or the long term?
Well, let me say that the clients that we're working with in all of the projects that are being developed in the U.S. include some sort of carbon capture and storage process. Specifically in looking at the areas where the concentration of these plants are being proposed, they are in reasonably close proximity for application enhanced oil recovery. And quite frankly, for first plants that are probably going to have a premium on them because of the technology risk in these early plants, quite frankly, it requires that CO2 capture and sale to capture that value of the CO2 in enhanced oil recovery. So in my opinion, that's going to be not just a requirement in terms of legislation, in terms of emission standards, but it's an economic requirement of being able to find useful markets for that CO2.
Thank you. And, sir, in the front row, you've got the last question. Your comment.
I'm Bob Hershey. I'm a consultant. Could you discuss the implications of using coal versus using natural gas in making these liquids as far as capital costs and costs of the product and other considerations?
Well, I'll start out. As I mentioned in my presentation, a Fischer-Tropsch reactor really doesn't care where the molecules came from as long as you have the proper ratio of hydrogen and CO, and the synthesis gas has been cleaned to protect the catalysis process. In coal to liquids, about 75% of the capital cost of a plant is in the gasification portion of the plant. So that's an expensive capital percentage. So in terms of capital cost, a coal-to-liquids plant, all-in, total installed capital, will be quite a bit higher than a equivalent-size gas-to-liquids plant, just because of the cost of the handling, the coal handling, and processing and the gasification side.
I would just say that it's important when you look at, I think I mentioned this before, when you look at these new synthetic fuel businesses, it's important to realize that they're highly, really, I think the way they're going to evolve is they are fully integrated businesses. Now, you may or may not be able to manage them that way, but I don't think it's a coincidence, for example, that the Athabasca tar sands development, that you're seeing tar sands producers do deals with other companies so that they get end-to-end. Mm-hmm. And I think to say what's the capital cost, that's a crucial factor. I would agree completely, but I think we would model it all the way from, well, if you own the resource and you go all the way through the plant all the way to markets, and that includes all the infrastructure issues, your ability to manage fluctuations in the commodity prices, internalize them, do all those things, that's how I think you have to look at the economics. Because in the end, it's the whole value chain that determines the business value of a given resource, whether it's gas, whether it's coal. You're going to have all of them, because there are enough variations of circumstances that will allow for one business value chain for coal to outperform one business value chain for gas and vice versa. But I don't think it's one item. I think these businesses are more integrated than the current petroleum business, which used to be that way, all the way back to Rockefeller, understood that you needed vertical integration, but that was when the industry was young. Over time, the markets allow for efficiencies and scale to disaggregate those value chains. But I think as you spring about a new fuel system, it's not unreasonable to think that the integrated value chains is how these businesses are going to be constructed.
I might make another comment in terms of integration. Because of the large cost of the gasification side, I think you're going to see a combination of IGCC plus Fischer-Tropsch in combination, and you maybe heard the term polygeneration, where you're running the gasifier at optimum and maybe shifting the products from electricity to Fischer-Tropsch. There's been some concepts of making electricity during the peak hours of the day high price, shifting to Fischer-Tropsch at night. and integrating that with ammonia plants or other chemical plants, basically using the same building blocks of synthesis gas, hydrogen, and CO. So I think that that integration across the full value chain is where you're going to see some of these first plants built.
You know, one of the things we haven't heard today was any discussion of nuclear. I mean, in a carbon-constrained world and in a world that needs hydrogen to convert these, upgrade these hydrocarbons, you wonder that if over the period of time we're looking at obvious political challenges and some technical challenges, but you really wonder if a combination of nuclear sourcing for power and hydrogen mixed with these others, you're talking about basically producing CO2-free hydrogen production, which would change the balance for synthetic fuels as well. So we didn't talk about that. I think it's something that's still perhaps in flux, but I think it's hard to imagine in a carbon-constrained world the discussion of nuclear power doesn't come about.
Well, on that note, it's always the sign of a good meeting when questions or reactions are left on the table. I apologize for those of you who didn't get to intervene. Let me remind you once again, Frank and Doug already suggested this, but we will have additional events. 24th of February, is that right? But please watch your email. 22nd of February? All right. We'll work it out. 20th of February, thank you. We'll get it right on our side, I promise. So watch your emails, please. We look forward to involving you in the next session. In the meantime, will you please join me in thanking four exceptional speakers here today. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.